This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New York, Vietnam, a home, a cradle, a point of departure. The Vietnamese word Nguyen embraces the duality of land and water with an idea of home. Through a nuanced examination of the meaning of homeland and politics of belonging, Evan Le Espiritu Gandhi proposes Nguyen to understand complex positionality of refugee settlers on land suffered through the traumas of U.S. empire, militarization, and settler colonialism. Division in area studies has foreclosed conversations on how histories of settler colonialism and empire bring to light unexpected connections between indigenous people and settlers across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. By bringing together Vietnamese refugee settlers in Israel, Palestine, and Guam, Gandhi asked the difficult question of how we can imagine decolonial futurities when the creation of home for refugee settlers was predicated on the settler colonial project of dispossessing indigenous people. Drawing inspiration from Nguyen that embraces contradictions through relationality, Gandhi charts both the archipelago of U.S. empire and resistance to imagine decolonization based on fraught acknowledgement of histories and relationalities between people, land, and water. I am pleased to welcome Evan today at the New Books Network in Asian American Studies to talk about her new work, Archipelago of Resettlement, Vietnamese Refugee Settlers and Decolonization Across Guam and Israel, Palestine. Evan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited to be able to talk about your new book. First, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. So I am a second generation Vietnamese Filipina. I grew up in Oceanside, Southern California, on the traditional homelands of the Luseno, Juanero, and Kumeyaay peoples, and actually right next to Camp Pendleton, which is a military base that processed Vietnamese refugees in 1975 after the Vietnam War. And I am currently an assistant professor of Asian American Studies at UCLA, and I'm situated on the ancestral, unceded, and traditional homelands of the Gabrielino Tongva peoples, also known as Tavangar. So I like to say that this book has two beginnings in a way. So I first started writing this project when I was a PhD student in the rhetoric department at UC Berkeley. So my very first class that I took as a graduate student in fall 2013 was Comparative Diasporas with Professor Daniel Boyarin. And in this class, we really thought about Jewish diaspora alongside Black Atlantic diaspora to critique forms of nationalism that were really tied to the nation state structure, right? And thinking more about expansive and transnational and diasporic forms of community building. So for this class, I was like, how am I going to connect my previous interest in Vietnamese refugees and Vietnamese refugee diaspora to the theories and concepts that we were discussing in this class, right, for my term paper? And through this, I actually kind of stumbled upon this very small community of Vietnamese refugees who were resettled in the state of Israel and became Vietnamese Israeli citizens. So this was one way to sort of tap into and be in conversation with a lot of the Jewish diaspora critiques of Zionism and the Zionist state. And I realized that this case study of Vietnamese Israelis was something that hadn't been written a lot about before, partially because it was a relatively small population of about 366 Vietnamese refugees in Israel. And so it became a case study to open up larger questions that I had around indigeneity, around decolonization politics, around diaspora, and how to think about Vietnamese refugee resettlement in conversation with those structures. So the second beginning for this book is also tied to the second case study that the book looks like, right? So Vietnamese refugees who were processed in Guahan or Guam, an unincorporated territory of the U.S. Since 1898. So my mom and grandmother are actually Vietnamese refugees. They left Vietnam in April 1975. And after passing through a military base in the Philippines, they too were processed in Guam under what became Operation New Life, which was run by the U.S. military, though had a lot of participation from the local government of Guam. And over 112,000 Vietnamese refugees were processed in Guam during this time period. And so I really wanted to think about and trace my own family history to these sites in relation to the ongoing Chamorro decolonization movement that is happening in Guam. And again, you know, besides from the historian Jana Lipman, a lot of people had also not talked about Guam's important role in the Vietnamese refugee resettlement processes. You know, I think that a lot of focus is on the U.S. mainland, which is where a lot of Vietnamese refugees ended up, right? So thinking about Vietnamese Americans in the continental U.S. But in that continental discourse, I think that we continue to overlook and overshadow, you know, these other spaces of U.S. militarism and U.S. empire, such as the island of Guam, that kind of fall out of our narratives and our analysis. So I think it was also just paying homage to that history of Vietnamese refugees' relationality, right, with the island of Guam and the Chamorro people.
Thank you so much for a really thorough, you know, explanation and going back to how your project came about. I was also really struck by how, you know, you really intentionally, you know, do not look at the U.S., the mainland, but, you know, pay really careful attention to, you know, Guam and Israel, Palestine as these other sites of, you know, U.S. militarization that is often overshadowed in the scholarly focus that really privileges the mainland as a site. Actually, when you mention, you know, like Guahan, I was wondering whether you could actually speak to the audience a little bit about, you know, your word choices, because obviously, like, the words are very politicized, and you mentioned this in your book as well about, you know, why you decided to use, for example, the word Guam instead of, like, Guahan, and, you know, what are the political implications and considerations you went through when you were deciding on what terminologies to use in your book.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So as you say, you know, terms and terminologies are very vexed, particularly for spaces of contested land, right? So spaces of settler colonialism, where there is an active and ongoing indigenous resistance movement. So for Gwahan, right, which is the Chamorro term for the southernmost island of the Marianas Archipelago, the sort of U.S. imposed term, right, or naming of the island is Guam, so G-U-A-M. And I decided to default to the term Guam for the majority of the book for several reasons. So one, you know, it is the key term that comes out of a lot of archival documents that I was in conversation with, as well as the term that most of my interlocutors for the oral histories were using. So it was something that I wanted to respect. But also, I wanted to clearly index the ongoing territorial and, quite frankly, colonial status of Guam, right? That this vision of a decolonized Guam, of course, is happening in the sort of everyday interactions and forms of resistance that are happening in Guam and in the diaspora. But in terms of political status, you know, I didn't want to overlook or romanticize the fact that Guam is still a U.S. unincorporated territory. And so in the book project, I wanted to intentionally reserve the term Gwahan for explicit visions of a decolonized Guam. So there are points in the book where I use the term Gwahan instead. And it is very much in conversation with Chamorro as well as Vietnamese American visions, both in politics as well as cultural production, of what decolonization can look like in that space. It's also, of course, you know, a conversation and a debate that I had in regards how to name the land, right, which is Palestine, but which is also now the state of Israel. And, you know, I think that there are, of course, a lot of Palestinian scholars and activists who intentionally name the land Palestine. And that is something that I do intentionally do in parts of the book. But I also wanted to highlight that Palestinians had no political say over whether or not Vietnamese refugees were resettled in the state of Israel. So I wanted to index Israelis' power in that decision, right, and sort of unilateral decision making, and really highlight the vexed positionality of Vietnamese Israelis, right? They are Israeli citizens and therefore implicated in Zionist policies of ongoing Palestinian dispossession and displacement. So Israel-Palestine, you know, again, is kind of a vexed terminology that I try to use carefully throughout the book to index the sort of ongoing contestations around the land, right? As well as to sort of think about what would a binationalist future for this space look like.
Thank you so much for a really beautiful explanation as well. I also really appreciated your thoughtful discussion in the book about, you know, how you're respecting your interviewees as well as, you know, reflecting the archival documents, as well as how you reserve the term Gwahan for, you know, specifically talking about decolonial futurities. And as you said it so wonderfully, like, you are indexing, you know, the ongoing colonial power by purposefully, you know, using the terms such as, you know, Guam and also Israel-Palestine to think about, you know, the binationalist future. So yeah, I really appreciated your discussion on terminologies and its power. So my next question was actually about the analytical framework, which I think would be really important for the audience as we start to talk more about the content of the book. So as we talked about in the beginning with Nyok, you propose it as an analytical framework in the beginning when you talk about the myth of Vietnam and like how it emerged out of the consummation of land and water, which was just a really beautiful mythology. And I was wondering whether you could tell the audience a little bit more about Nyok and why you decided to use it as your analytical framework.
Sure. Thank you for the question. So Nyok means several things in Vietnamese. So first, it means water, but it also means country and homeland. So I was really interested in this duality or non-opposition between land and water, and thought that this was a helpful analytic for thinking about deterritorialized understandings of land and water and space, right, which really got at this question of fluidity and movement, while also sort of acknowledging that land is a key analytic for, example, indigenous decolonization movements. So it was something that emerged from Vietnamese diasporic epistemologies, and that was something that was important to me to really theorize alongside and be grounded in the epistemologies of the communities that I was in conversation with and really trying to think alongside in this text. So maybe just to explain, the Vietnamese creation story that you alluded to. So Alka, the mountain fairy, had 100 children with Lạc Long Quân, the sea dragon king, right? So here we have this sort of union, right, of the mountains and the land with the sea and the water. But out of that union, it actually produced division and conflict, right? So actually, the half of the children ended up moving back to the mountains and half of the children ended moving back to the sea. And so I think that it's also a myth that talks about union, but also division. And that's something that I wanted to hold that complexity, right, in the project as well. So I think that's another way that the analytic functions, right? There's always, I think, this aspiration for decolonial solidarities that underlines the project, but I also didn't want to shy away from the very real divisions and structural antagonisms that come out of what I'm calling the refugee settler condition.
Yeah, exactly. And that just really transitions perfectly to the next question that I have in mind. And, you know, this like duality of, you know, union and division that in a way this analytic also holds together so beautifully. So you are theorizing, you know, refugee settler condition in your book. And I was wondering whether you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, so the refugee settler condition I use as a concept to think about the vexed positionality of refugee subjects. So in my case, Vietnamese refugees, but I think that the term and the analytic can circulate more broadly. So thinking about the vexed positionality of refugee subjects who were resettled or get citizenship in particular in settler colonial states, right? And how that process and that citizenship is predicated on the unjust dispossession of indigenous peoples. And so really it's imbued and motivated by this question of what happens when forcibly displaced refugees are resettled in settler colonial states, right? And really, what is their ethical relationality to ongoing indigenous sovereignty movements? That's the real sort of decolonial or political question that motivates me. And so, you know, theoretically, I really was interested in putting conversations that were happening in critical refugee studies in relation to conversations happening in settler colonial and in indigenous studies, because I think that they're not always in such direct relation or conversation with each other, though I think that the fields have a lot to learn from one another. So critical refugee studies, which really looks at the refugee figure as a form of analytical critique, to critique larger structures of power, such as empire, war, and militarism. Also thinking about the refugee as a complex being and a storied agent, right, with who can forge their own stories that we need to attend to. But the figure of the refugee, I think, also highlights some of the limitations of a nation-state structure, which is predicated on this division between who is included in the nation and who is excluded or who is stateless and therefore doesn't access rights or human rights or even the sort of acknowledgement of the complexity of one's full being. Who are outside of the nation, right? And so I really wanted to think about how critical refugee studies offers us, you know, that critique of a nation state order. But settler colonial indigenous studies hones in more particularly to think about the settler colonial state, right? So what happens when that nation state sovereignty is predicated on indigenous dispossession, genocide, displacement, exclusion, right? So I really wanted to put refugee forms of forced displacement in relation to indigenous forms of forced displacement to think about that relationality, while again, really attending to that structural antagonism of once refugees do get citizenship, right? Or once they are incorporated into the settler colonial state, then they have to attend to their vexed relation to those who are still considered outside of the space of that settler colonial state, right? Which is indigenous folks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, throughout your book, I was really struck by how you draw relationalities. So, you know, like, on the one hand, you do, you know, really pay attention to the structural antagonism. But then also you look at, you know, the instances of connections and relationalities that happen most often through cultural production, as well as interviews that you conduct with, you know, your interviewees. So I was actually wondering whether you could tell us more about, you know, like the relationships that you had with your interviewees and, you know, how you theorize like relationalities through, you know, reading like different poems, as well as, you know, listening to the stories told by Chamorro activists, as well as different documentaries and poems by, you know, Vietnamese Americans in Guam and Israel, Palestine.
Yeah, so maybe I will talk a little bit first about the oral histories that I conducted. So I had done a lot of archival research, but archives, you know, I think are told from the perspective of those in power, right? So I wanted to conduct oral histories to really think about and understand the lived experiences of refugee and indigenous displacement. But I think that, you know, actually I had a harder time engaging with and really figuring out how to write alongside and write about the oral histories that I conducted. Which is to say, I think that I was trained in a particular modality of critique in my dissertation program, right, or my graduate program in rhetoric. So in some ways, I felt really well-trained to analyze the structures of power that were coming across in the sort of government documents and the sort of militarized and political rhetoric that U.S. military as well as Zionist leaders were articulating and how they talked about Vietnamese refugees. But a lot of the oral histories that I conducted with resettled Vietnamese refugees in Guam as well as in Israel-Palestine, for those folks, there was a sincere sense of gratitude towards the settler colonial state, right? And a very intense attachment to the settler colonial state as the space of resettlement, right? Of course, there were also other forms of dissent and critique, but for the most part, there was a kind of sense of wariness, right, or concern or uncertainty about Chamorro decolonization movements or the Palestinian liberation movement. So I wanted to think about, you know, how can I really attend to and take seriously these stories and lived experiences of displacement from Vietnam, right? And, you know, this is something that in chapter two, I take a step back and think about as refugee settler desire, right? Actually think about those affective attachments to the settler colonial state and to grapple with them. But, you know, it was actually something that I had to take some time away from the project before I was able to enter more fully in conversation, I think, with those oral histories that I conducted with resettled Vietnamese refugees in particular. You know, they were oral histories that I conducted while I was still a graduate student, but I don't think that they were fully integrated into the dissertation version of the project. And it took a couple years, you know, after I had graduated and was working on the book manuscript revisions that I was able to find, you know, a more careful and respectful way to attend, you know, I think to these stories and to interweave them into the project.
Yeah, I really appreciated that because also in my own research, you know, I think as a researcher, you know, we are trained to really see this like structural power and to critique them. And, you know, when our interviewees say something that maybe doesn't match our expectation or, you know, like show like affective attachment to these forms of power, like I think for me, like it posed like a concern about like, oh, so how do I then, you know, like integrate this into my research? And I thought that, you know, you did a really wonderful, you know, like work that really respects their voices while, you know, highlighting the structural elements that I really appreciated. Kind of going back to, you know, what you were talking about archives, you know, and how it is, you know, produced by people with power. I did also want to ask you a question about archives as well, because, you know, I do think that you do a really wonderful job in a way relating, you know, the archival, you know, research with like the oral histories, you know, through what you discuss with the archipelago of, you know, resettlement in a way, like holding both the resistance part as well as militarization. Can you tell us more about your journey with the official archives and how the archive as a dominant institution, you know, shaped the types of materials and stories you were able to access?
Yeah, so I was able to visit three main archives. There are a couple smaller archives that I access either online or in shorter visits, but I want to highlight three that were integral to the project. So the Institute of Palestine Studies in Ramallah, as well as the Israel State Archive. And then the third main one was the Micronesian Area Research Center at the University of Guam in Guahan. So the first archive that I actually went to was the Institute of Palestine Studies in Ramallah. And this was a really interesting space because I think that the idea and practice of archiving is really one of a expression of state sovereignty and sort of independence, right? Because in order for a state to archive its own documents, it is a political sort of cultivation or curation, right, of what are the documents that can really narrate the history as well as the power of that state. So I think that it was really interesting to see this really real expression, right, of Palestinian sovereignty that was happening in this archive and in this institute. So I was directed to the Institute of Palestine Studies by one of my interlocutors. I was really interested in thinking about Vietnam-Palestine solidarity, particularly within the Cold War and Third World solidarity movement that happened in the late 60s and early 70s in particular. And this interlocutor told me, oh, there's this speech by Ho Chi Minh, who is there, which is in the archive, in which he expresses solidarity with the Palestinian liberation struggle. So I went to find this speech in this archive and actually found a much larger wealth of documents in the archive. So in particular, I was accessing these anthologies that were entitled the International Documents of Palestine. And these were really, again, sort of curations of thinking about Palestine as a space and as a power that had international and international relations, right, with other political parties, with other decolonization struggles, anti-colonial struggles, with other states. So thinking about Palestine as an international, right, sort of body or institution. And by going through these anthologies from 1967 all the way up to 1975, I was able to track these other invocations of how Vietnam and Palestine intersected, whether it was in the speeches of other stakeholders or in direct addresses between Vietnam and Palestine. So that was something that was really exciting to me. So I want to talk now about my experiences with the Israel State Archive, right? So actually around the time that I was doing research, Israel made the decision to actually close its archives to researchers, to people who were interested in accessing the archives, and set up a very sort of explicit body or structure of mediation, which is to say that people couldn't directly access the archive. You had to go to the archivist and tell them what the topic you were interested in looking at or researching was. And then they would do a level of curation, right? And it was unclear how much sort of editing and cutting and leaving out they do, right, in this process. But basically, they go into the archive, they select the documents that they want you to see, and then they give them to you. And then there is kind of this level of you have to trust or not trust that what they give you is comprehensive, right? So I think in some ways for this project, I was fortunate that the State of Israel is actually quite proud of its magnanimity and its humanity and its sort of humanitarianism, I guess, in resettling Vietnamese refugees in 1977 and 1979. So, you know, whoever was in power in the Israel State Archive was actually quite open into sharing a lot of these documents, including secret telegrams that were passed back and forth, sort of government correspondence about the very real debates that were actually happening in regards to whether or not Israel were going to accept not only the first wave, but then the second and third wave of Vietnamese refugees into the State of Israel. So in a lot of ways, that sort of back and forth and those internal debates that were happening sort of were able to counter the official state narrative of, oh, of course, you know, we wanted to accept Vietnamese refugees. We as the State of Israel identify as a nation of, in particular, Holocaust refugees. And therefore, we are in a particular position to identify with these displaced Vietnamese refugees. Of course, this official narrative, we're really explicitly eliding and occluding the ongoing processes of Palestinian displacement and refugeehood and exile, right? So really thinking about, again, the sort of state power and nation state building power of an archive, such as the Israel State Archive. And the last place that I visited, our key archival site, was the Micronesian Area Research Center at the University of Guam. I had a wonderful experience conducting research there on Operation New Life and Guam's role in the Vietnamese refugee resettlement process. There were sort of clear boxes that were already had been set aside to cultivate a lot of the newspaper documents, for example, as well as government documents and photos that had to do with Vietnamese refugee resettlement. And so it was great to see, you know, sort of a day by day how these newspapers as well as government officials were writing about and grappling with Vietnamese refugees, as well as to compare and contrast, you know, how the explicit U.S. military newspapers might have represented Operation New Life a little bit differently than some of the civilian newspapers, such as the PDN or Pacific Daily News.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you so much for your really like thoughtful and also really in-depth, you know, thought processes that you had as you analyze some of these documents, as well as like the gatekeeping that happens, especially with the Israel State Archives and the mediated information and representation that often elides displacement, ongoing displacement that happens. Thank you so much for that. And you know, when you were talking about, you know, the Institute of Palestinian Studies and, you know, the solidarity, like the extensive solidarity documents that you have found, I was actually thinking about how, you know, comparative studies is often very difficult. And people also criticize comparative studies for, you know, often like flattening out differences. And I think there are a lot of opposition that you can find in scholarship. But I thought that, you know, you did a really compelling job of, you know, illustrating like why it matters and, you know, why you intentionally decided to do a comparative study. So can you tell us more about, you know, your thought process, as well as if you received actually any opposition about doing comparative studies, and, you know, why you decided that, you know, like, you know, in the end, like drawing the connections between settler colonial condition is important for a decolonial project.
I don't know if I received any direct opposition yet. So I think it was more sort of a questioning process that my dissertation committee had for me, as well as, you know, sort of in the writing and the book revision process as well. You know, so I think that people acknowledge that this is a risky project, right? There is a certain element of risk of really being able to attend to the different communities in which you are in conversation with, right? So I have a familial and political and community relation to Vietnamese refugees and the Vietnamese refugee community. But prior to this project, you know, I didn't have a direct conversation or connection to the Chamorro diaspora, as well as Chamorros in Guam, as well as the Palestinian liberation movement. So, you know, thinking about activism around Palestine, which of course has been going on for decades, you know, it wasn't something that I was really introduced to until actually graduate school. In particular, you know, in the summer of 2014, thinking about the airstrikes of Gaza, it really, you know, I think prompted me to think about my positionality as a second generation Vietnamese Filipina and really think about, okay, how can I use my not only political skills, but also research skills to really attend to how I can think about my role in this Palestinian solidarity movement, right? So I think that was also one of the political impulses for this project. But I think a lot of the questions that I got were, you know, why are you looking at these sort of marginal spaces, right, of U.S. militarism and U.S. empire, particularly because so much of the Vietnamese refugees ended up in the continental U.S. You know, I think there are a lot of questions of why don't you sort of center, you know, again, recenter the continental U.S. Within your project. And that was something that I really wanted to, you know, as you note, draw people's attention to these other occluded spaces, right, that have fallen out of dominant narratives of Vietnamese refugee resettlement in a lot of ways. So I think attending to Guahan and Israel-Palestine, which are, you know, increasingly discussed in Asian American studies and American studies, though I think a lot more attention still needs to be directed at them to think about the ways that there are particular histories of, excuse me, to think about how their particular histories of U.S. militarism and U.S. Intervention, you know, really force us, I think, in Asian American studies to rethink how we think about U.S. empire. So I wanted to put, you know, Israel-Palestine and Guahan in conversation to think about of spaces of U.S. empire that have been overlooked, that are seeming on the margins of these grand historical narratives, but that putting them in conversation can illuminate what I call or think about as an archipelago of U.S. empire, right? Or to think about the archipelagic nature of U.S. empire, to think about how U.S. intervention in the Vietnam War is actually linked to U.S. military buildup in Guahan, as well as U.S. military aid, financial and political aid to the State of Israel that really started accelerated in that same Cold War moment, right? So thinking about these historical and political linkages. But I also wanted to think about an archipelago of trans-indigenous resistance. And I'm borrowing that term trans-indigenous from Chadwick Allen, which is to say, you know, of course, all of these place-based movements for decolonization are also linked with one another, right? So thinking about how the Chamorro decolonization movement is linked to the Palestinian liberation struggle. And one way we can think about those conceptual and political linkages is to trace the material passage of the Vietnamese refugee figure to these sites, right? And thinking about how they are interrelated, not only through these tendrils of U.S. militarism and U.S. empire, but also these interlinked forms of forced displacement and political resistance.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this. Yeah. Again, like really like beautiful, like interweaving and, you know, illustrating the relationalities, because, yeah, I think, you know, one of the main points in your book about, you know, how the militarization, you know, and the intervention is like linked, you know, like really link these like quote unquote like marginal spaces actually together, and then showed how it was actually like fundamental to the process, which I think is also a really important intervention that you're making about, you know, why we need to like decenter the mainland, and, you know, to understand like why the marginal is like not marginal when we look think about the intersection and interconnection was a really, I think, a salient point that I think really resonated with me as well. And I wanted to actually connect this conversation about, you know, so in your book, you talk about your methodology and, you know, why you decided to do archipelagic history rather than, you know, transnational or world history. So you talked about this a little bit with the previous question, but can you tell us more about, you know, what is archipelagic history and, you know, how this is allowing you to really center relationalities?
Awesome. Thank you for the question. So archipelagic history is something that I discuss and theorize most explicitly in chapter one, but it is a methodology that I think informs the rest of the book project and how to read, you know, the rest of the book. So as you mentioned, you know, archipelagic history, I wanted to think about it as a way to trace connections between spaces on the seeming margins, right, of grand historical narratives. in order to draw attention to South-South relations. So thinking about the exchange of political knowledge, military strategy, solidarity rhetoric, but also intimate relations and connections between subjects of the global South that were resistant to aggression, right, from the global North. So I think that archaeologic history upends linear notions of causal temporality. I think it allows us to attend to actually concurrent reverberations of war and imperialism across multiple sites. And, you know, as you mentioned, unlike other models of writing history that I was reading about, so thinking about world history, global history, transnational history, or even diasporic history, archaeopologic history is not organized around a particular empire, a particular superpower, or nation state, or ethnic diaspora, right? So thinking about something that can move more rhizomatically, you know, maybe fractally, and thinking about the archaeopologic, you know, as a form as well that was emerging from our particular sites of analysis, right? So again, really attending to and learning from the epistemologies of the communities that I was in conversation with this project, right? So just to go back a little bit, you know, I wanted to think about how Guam, which is a U.S. territory, is actually part of a larger Marianas archipelago, right, or a larger archaeopologic Chamorro homeland. And to reattend to that archaeopologic imaginary, right, is a decolonial sort of project in and of itself, because it speaks against this division of political division, which has been going on for centuries, right, of Guam from the rest of the Northern Mariana Islands. And, you know, Palestine is less obviously an archipelago in the literal sense, but I was really drawing from this map by the artist Julian Busak to think about the archipelago of Eastern Palestine, but more broadly to think about the archaeopologic nature of Palestinian sovereignty, right, and how these Palestinian life worlds are increasingly sort of being divided up by Israeli and Zionist encroachment, right? So the non-contiguous forms of Palestinian life worlds. So I think the archaeopologic as well connects back to this concept of Nuuk that we had begun with, right? So this sort of land-water dialectic that is imbued in the term Nuuk is also something that I think is informed by this idea of the archaeopologic as something that is made up of both land and water and therefore can be really rooted in place-based land struggles, as well as having this undercurrent, right, of water, fluidity, movement, waves, which is informing this sort of methodology, informing this methodology of archaeopologic history. So, you know, in particular, in that chapter, I wanted to trace different forms of U.S. military empire across oceans and continents in order to really chart how Vietnam, Palestine, and Guam were entangled in the U.S. imperial imagination between, in particular in this project, 1967 and 1975. So those dates are important because I really wanted to think about even prior to Vietnamese refugee displacement and migration, which happens post-1975, so after the fall of Saigon, right? How are these spaces actually entangled, right, in the U.S. military imaginary and U.S. imperial imaginary? And this was one way to think about how this entanglement actually prefigured the routes that post-1975 Vietnamese refugees were taken, right, after displacement in the aftermath of the U.S. war in Vietnam. So that chapter one, you know, looks at that solidarity rhetoric between Vietnam and Palestine that I mentioned in relation to the Institute of Palestine Studies archive. But it also looks at oral histories with Chamorro Vietnam War veterans. So thinking about these intimate relations that actually exceed in a lot of ways how the U.S. military was positioning Guam, but also in particular U.S. military bases in Guam, so Anderson Air Force Base, as well as Naval Station Guam, Thinking about that dominant way that Guam was positioned as this militarized space that made intervention into Vietnam, you know, on a sort of practical and logistical level, actually possible. But I think that, you know, these Chamorro Vietnam War veterans, their sort of intimate and quotidian romances, as well as friendships, you know, with Vietnamese military folk as well as civilians, offers us another way to think about, you know, those connections that were made under these structures of war and settler colonialism and empire building.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And, you know, your thought on, you know, archipelagic history and, you know, how that really allows you to, you know, along with New York, really center your analysis on like land-based struggles, as well as, you know, how the oral histories in a way really highlight the quotidian, you know, connections and friendships that in a way really like, that really go beyond, you know, the structural narratives that we often see, you know, in the archives, which, yeah, I also really appreciated as well. And that brings me to, you know, how you also, you know, analyze the poems and, you know, also like a documentary on Bon Nguyen, to rethink decolonization through land politics. Can you tell us a little bit more about the importance of these type of cultural works by the important poets like Van Nguyen and how they illustrate the importance of, you know, land, water, and histories and reimagining solidarity?
Yeah, for sure. So definitely this is a very interdisciplinary project. You know, I was engaging with archival documents as well as oral histories, but cultural production was also a very important form of thinking about cultural production as a way to theorize, you know, alongside these communities, but also for giving us visions of what decolonial solidarities could look like, right? So as I mentioned, you know, in a lot of the oral histories that I conducted with Vietnamese refugees in Guam as well as in Israel-Palestine, these connections and these solidarities weren't happening on a sort of mass scale, right, in terms of social movement building yet, right? And so the first part of the project was really attending to why that was happening, right? Why did we have these structural antagonisms? Why was there this intense feelings and affects of refugee settler desire to identify with a settler state? So I wanted to turn to cultural production, though, for these visions of what decolonial futurities could look like, right? I don't think that in any way they are foreclosed. And so Raymond Williams' concept of structures of feelings were really helpful for me in this regard, right? So thinking about emergent affects as well as feelings and political visions and what he called as structures of feelings that were not quite there, right, in the social realm yet in terms of social movements. But we can see hints of it that are rising up and are erupting, right, into our present realities. And so, as you mentioned, some of the cultural productions that I look at is the poetry of Vietnamese Israeli Van Nguyen. So her volume, The Truffle Eye, I really want to think about the exilic affects in her poems, which really, I think, push against this idea of a successful Vietnamese refugee resettlement and identification with the Zionist Israeli state. And in particular, to put her poetry in conversation with and read it alongside Palestinian poetry, right? So in particular, I look at Mourid Barghouti's I Saw Ramallah, which is this long form sort of memoir poem. And thinking about these ways that these exilic affects and exilic poetics can critique a nation state structure and thinking about ongoing forms of exile and displacement that are routed through Nuuk, right, as an analytic of deterritorialization, right, as this land-water politics that can disrupt a nation-state model of community building and organization. And the other, you know, sort of film that I look at in that chapter, chapter six, is entitled The Journey of Van Wing. So thinking about in this film how Van Wing, the poet, as well as her father, Hoai Mi Wing, go back to Vietnam, and they actually try to reclaim their ancestral lands that they were forced to give up and surrender when they fled Vietnam as anti-communist refugees, right? So after they fled, you know, these lands were expropriated by the post-war communist state of Vietnam and redistributed, right? And so I think that this gives us one way to think about how the refugee settler condition is also traveling, right? Diasporically, archipelagically, across different states. And so maybe if solidarity between Vietnamese Israelis and Palestinians within the, you know, sort of bounded nation state of the State of Israel, sometimes that might feel so impossible, right? But if we think broadly and more archipelagically and routed through these routes of Nuuk, right? I want to think about how this film gives us a way to think about how when the refugee settler condition and Vietnamese refugees travel back to their homeland in Vietnam, for example, and actually translate the vocabulary of ex-land contestations from the Israel-Palestine context back to Vietnam and are engaging in their own sort of land reclamation struggles, right? In some ways that are very similar to Palestinian struggles for the right of return, right? The right to return to their ancestral villages and homelands and farmlands, et cetera. And so thinking about how these archaeological movements, right, and the translations and resonances that they open up can be one way to think about these decolonial futurities and solidarities that you are mentioning.
Thank you so much for that. And I also just loved how this like idea of translation was, you know, like used in like many different ways in both metaphorical and also like material ways in which you really connect, yeah, the Palestinian idea of return as well as, you know, the refugee settlers, you know, like idea of reclamation with the vexed condition of ongoing struggles to really imagine the possibilities of, you know, decolonial futurity. So yeah, I really loved, you know, like how you used the idea of translation in your book as well. Before I ask you the traditional NBN question about your next project, I wanted to, you know, ask you actually more about like decolonization, because in the conclusion, you talk about how, you know, there's also a danger of co-optation in narratives when you talk about how, you know, like the corporations are also kind of like reimagining like water, you know, like as like a place of settlement. So there is this, you know, like, again, like duality and like a danger of co-optation of narratives. So yeah, when you were talking about, you know, decolonization, I wanted to ask you more about, you know, all these like intimate encounters that you kind of saw in your oral histories as well as cultural productions, and whether, you know, they're like what kind of, in a way, like decolonial like methodologies you have been seeing in the book that you wanted to mention, other than the one that you just spoke of right now with translation?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I am really interested in these quotidian forms of cultural production, as well as, you mentioned, interaction, right? We can think about oral history itself as a kind of narrative and narrative building, right? How does one narrate one's life and where one is going, right? That's also a way to narrate different political visions for the future. So maybe another, you know, text that I will highlight is a blog by a mixed Vietnamese tomorrow. She was a student at the University of Guam when she wrote it, but now she's actually a teacher, Bianca Wing. And while she was a student at the University of Guam, she wrote what was called the Decolonization Conversation Blog, And I think this was important because, you know, again, I wanted to think about cultural production more expansively, right? It's not just the published poems and it's not just, you know, the documentaries that win awards and circulate transnationally, but it's also these really quotidian embodied forms of narrative, right, that individuals put out on the internet and that are then archived more ephemerally, right, in the digital space. And so I was really interested in how she was thinking about decolonization, not only from the perspective of her Chamorro heritages and those inheritances from her mother's side of the family, but also thinking about how this question of decolonization that is ongoing in Guam and in Guahan is actually also important for the Vietnamese refugee side of her family and those inheritances, right, from her father's side of the family, which is to say, thinking about how, you know, U.S. militarism, as I mentioned, is in Vietnam, is connected to U.S. military buildup in Guahan. So we need to think about these processes, but also political struggles as interlinked.
Oh, thank you so much for, like, again, like, you know, highlighting, like, many different forms of cultural production, as well as the importance of, you know, like, quotidian forms on intimate connections that really show us the decolonial possibilities of decolonial futurities. So I've taken up a lot of your time, so I wanted to conclude this podcast with the traditional MBN question, which is, what is the next project you're working on?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I'm working on two projects right now. So the first is an edited anthology with my wonderful co-editor, Vin Nguyen. And it's a Routledge handbook. So it's a Routledge handbook of refugee narratives. So I have loved working on this project. You know, we have about 38 chapters that we are editing and putting together into a collection. But it has given me an opportunity to think about refugee narratives and refugee political possibilities more expansively, right? So sort of outside of just the Vietnamese refugee case. So we're interested in opening up, you know, the figure of the refugee to think about not only those who have UNHCR recognition, but thinking about asylum seekers, you know, displaced indigenous communities and nations, thinking about Black fugitives and the afterlives of slavery, thinking about climate refugees, people who are considered economic migrants, right, and how racial capitalism is usually not seen as a credible fear of, you know, persecution in one's homeland. So thinking about refugees more expansively, but also thinking about narratives more expansively, right? So not only, you know, the traditional literature and film, as I had mentioned before, but also thinking about oral histories and archival documents, letters to the editor, you know, music, data narratives, video games, more expansively, right, to think about these different forms of narrative. So it has been such a wonderful learning process, I think, for me, you know, to think about also these larger geographical and historical narratives that, again, are preceding the 1951 Refugee Convention, but also thinking about these more forward-looking and, you know, very unfortunately unfolding sort of refugee sort of migrations, right? So thinking from Burma, Myanmar, Rohingya refugees, you know, thinking about Afghan refugees. And more recently, you know, of course, the sort of ongoing conflict in Ukraine and Ukrainian refugees that are being displaced, as well as, you know, sort of ongoing displacements from places like Sudan and Eritrea as well. So it's been a really great learning experience. The second project, you know, that I'm thinking about, so the second book project or the monograph, is broadly thinking about Southern connections and the archaeologic movement, you know, I think we can say, of Southern discourses and resonances and significations of what the South means. So in particular, I'm interested in looking at discursive and political and literary connections between South Vietnam, South Korea, and the U.S. South, which is to say the southern spaces that are invoked in these different civil war conflicts, and how they actually fall out, I think, in a lot of ways, out of global South studies and global South conversations, because they are often painted as conservative or anti-communist in a particular way. But I'm interested in thinking about, the South as not only the U.S. South, for example, is not only this space of sort of Confederate white nationalism that we see erupting, even today, and thinking about the South as well as, a space of the afterlives of slavery and Black resistance, right? And Black liberation struggles as a way to inform how we think about the South, perhaps in an Asian Cold War context. So thinking about some of the parallels as well as differences between U.S. military intervention and South Korea, as well as South Vietnam. So very early stages of the project, right now I'm really cultivating and curating, a collection of cultural production that is tracing these Southern parallels and Southern discourses. But I'm interested in, what other methodologies this project will sort of invite as well.
Yeah, thank you so much, Evan. Like, both sound really exciting. And I think definitely the anthropology, like anyone who reads your book, the listeners, definitely need to like check out this edited volume afterwards to, understand more about refugee narratives as well as different forms that it takes. And your question about, the archipelagic histories that connect the South together also just sound really exciting as well. And I look forward to reading it when it comes out. Thank you so much again, Evan, for being here. And thank you for a really wonderful, a podcast where you really elaborated, your beautiful monograph and its important contributions.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I really appreciated this conversation.
Thank you.